When you now calculate the momentum transfer, the rate of momentum transfer, which is the force, you find that the force between these two particles goes like an inverse square. So now you can think of it. Imagine a theory of gravity, you see, in which you've got all these little particles running around that you can't see. Matter is almost transparent to them with a little cross section. I call these particles neutrons, right? So one can invent in this way a kind of a theory of gravitation. Now, it turns out that there's a great difficulty with this, because you'd like to connect up the equivalence principle that says that the mass that appears as the generator or the source of the gravitational field is the same as the inertial mass. Okay. Now, conceivably, that would happen if you had this sea of neutrons, you know, moving in all directions, and you move a particle along here, it intersects more of these on the front side than the back side. The only trouble is, that's a velocity-dependent thing, not acceleration. So it doesn't go very far. But anyway, this theory goes back to about 1850, I guess, to a fellow by the name of Lesage. I didn't know about that, but...
The value of history again.
Yes, right. Oh, yes.
You list as being officially involved with the Manhattan Project from 44 to 46.
Yeah.
So you completed this work then, your thesis was out of the way.
Yeah.
You got your degree in 45, so mm-hmm. What can you tell me more about that period? The war was actually coming to an end.
Well, if you didn't know that.
No, that's true. 44 wouldn't have been obvious.
Right. But there was, general feeling on the part of the administrators that the war was going to end, and so at the end of 1944, I should preface this, the Columbia part of the Manhattan Project was carried on in several of the buildings, mainly in Pupin, which was the physics building, but also in Skermerhorn, which was where some of the engineering was going on. And Columbia decided to get out of that business at the end of 1944, and Union Carbide took over as manager of that. So there was a big garage building, formerly a garage building, up on 135th Street and Broadway. So Columbia sold us up the river to Union Carbide. And then, of course, things happened rapidly. In this May of 45, the European War was over. And in August, the first bombs were dropped in Japan. Again, this was an exciting period, because associated with that project, Harold Urey had been there, and Ray Crist, and Bill Libby, and Edward Teller was coming through, and,
How aware were you? You said earlier you had, as a graduate student, you were told just do this.
Yeah.
How did your awareness develop of what was really going on?
Well, you think about what they're telling you to do and you figure it out. And in one case, we had a set of instructions about, sort of do this, do that, do the other thing in this business of looking for the separation factor in the preferential solubility, and the instructions were wrong. I mean, if we'd followed those, they would have got results they couldn't interpret, because instead of adding up to 100%, things added up to 90%, and they just made a goof. But it's easy to figure out.
So did you move up the river then for the?
Oh yeah, I went up there, and in fact. I was stayed on until the last dog was hung, writing a history of the of that part of the Manhattan Project. Yeah.
Is that classified?
Yeah, it's a two-volume history, which Bill Libby always kept in his safe, and moved around with him, and he still had it when he died. Still classified.
That was something that came up in a conversation I had with somebody else recently, and that is how much of that time period is still classified, and and we're in an age where a lot of things are becoming public, but it seems a lot of that is still not...
Well, you know, there's a problem. The government hasn't solved the problem of classification. Right now, I'm interested in a study that was done for the Army. Back in 1970, I was a member of the Army Science Advisory Board, and we had a summer study on trying to look 20 years ahead for what kind of equipment the Army would need to, you know, foresee and get ready. And there was a group in the Army, big group, maybe 100 people, doing work on this, and they wrote a very fine report in which they looked at something like 300 countries. They had a bunch of quite a mix of capabilities amongst the this is a military operation, looking at objectives, national objectives of the country, what their problems are, what the potential conflicts, and then described these in terms of climate, terrain, political consider, the whole smear. Well, that would be very useful to something I'm doing now for the B-2 program. But that stuff is still classified secret. And what's worse, you see, if you're going to get something declassified, you got to go to the originator. There aren't any originators. That agency is long gone, all dispersed, so it's just on hold. There's no way of breaking that out. And I think that's what's happening with a lot of the that happens stuff. There are some real lessons to be learned, though. Those guys, you know, Bill Libby and company, really had courage, because they designed that whole diffusion plant before they had any barrier. In other words, they took a gamble that they were going to be able to develop that barrier. And in fact, about 3 months before it was due, we had three different kinds of barrier, all of which would work.
How soon did you receive your security clearance then?
Oh, God.
As a student, you didn't have one, I'm sure.
No, but... and I don't know what the system was in those days. I think... maybe Nancy would know. She's got records on all that stuff. I involved her in typing up that 2,000-page history.
Well, it's nice to know it exists, even if no one may ever see it.
There's a lesson there in that business of doing the research simultaneously with the plant design. You can't. You know, today it takes 10 years to get any weapon system in operation. But, by God, we had stuff coming out the top end of that plant in about 3 years.
Yes, it is a remarkable achievement. Edward Teller, you interacted with Teller, and I know after the war there were a number of papers that came out with you and Teller.
Yeah.
Where did you first meet Teller?
In this course that I told you, where he took over from Harold Urey. And Teller has an absolutely unique physical understanding that really hard to come by. I credit him with teaching me how to think. But I still, you know, I'm still amazed at the things he does. For example, we started when I got to Chicago after the war. we started to work on, among other things, since I had been interested in adsorption, and also, you see, Edward had been interested in that, and he's the E of the BET theory.
All right.
I'm sorry, the T of the BET theory, Punauer, Emmett, and Teller. And so this was a natural thing, and we began to look at the conformation of a surface that has piles of adsorbed molecules on it. That's the basis of one of these papers. And Edward was always seemed to be terribly short of time, you know, you're traveling back and forth a little almost a lot. And on one of these occasions, I went in to see him because we had in mind making a Fourier analysis of this. And he said, now, the entropy will go like the logarithm of the amplitude. So, I don't understand that at all. And so, about 3 weeks later, when I saw him, I had figured out, and I had a decent derivation that came out exactly that way. And he said, "Where did you get this?" I said, "Well, isn't that what you said?" So, one of the things that we did during that year was to look at the production of mesons, which in those days were called mesotrons. The idea was that you have a nucleus that has a bunch of nucleons in it. These have zero-point energy, so they're buzzing around all directions in that envelope, so to speak. So if you sock this with an incoming particle, you may get some benefit if one of these is moving in this direction and you hit it in this direction, then you get more than you bargained for because of the zero-point energy. So we pointed out that you'd have enough energy to make mesons by this process. And Luis Alvarez seized on that and produced them in the cyclotron. But he wouldn't have tried that experiment, he said, if this prediction hadn't been made.
Had you been giving any thought as the war ended, your thesis was in hand, had you been giving any thought as to what you wanted to do?
Oh, yes. In fact, I had carried on conversation with Bill Young. I wanted to come back to UCLA. And Bill was frequently in the East for various ACS things, so I would, when he came to New York, I would see him. And so he encouraged this arrangement with Edward Teller for a year, and then...
That's when you went to Chicago.
Yeah. And then I had this job waiting for me.
Why did you want to come back to UCLA?
Oh, climate and...
Family was still here?
Yeah. And I'd been to a number of universities in the East. I knew what Columbia was about in Chicago. In Chicago, we lived on the south side, across the track, so to speak. And the weather was just miserable, you know. And I remember walking across that mall one morning, and I slipped on the ice and nearly broke an arm. A miserable climate.
What did you do when you first got back to UCLA then?
Well, the very first thing was to teach a course in organic chemistry.
All that good statistical
stuff. But apparently they didn't find a guy to teach their summer session organic. And Bill offered me that job, you know, the pay in those days was pretty low. I think I started at $3,800 a year or something like that. And this was another $300 for teaching in the summer, so it was not a trivial amount. And so this was my first experience handling a class of my own. Quite a learning experience.
Well, you were probably getting GIs coming back then too.
Well, not quite then, but very soon after, we had the best students, the best graduate students that I'd ever seen, because these guys had been out, you know, and they were mature, and they knew what they wanted, mm-hmm. and they were a gung-ho bunch, just great.
You, in the summary that you sent me, you had essentially delineated your activities from coming back to UCLA on in three different areas. Mm-hmm. And I thought what I might do is try to follow through on what you called the academic science.
Yeah, okay.
First, look at some changes that occurred along the way, then mm-hmm. come back, because I am quite interested in your government mm-hmm. military activities as mm-hmm. well. I'm not sure if we can really separate that, because obviously they were going on at the same time, but you in 1953 you had a paper on the nuclear stability curve.
Yes.
Which you've commented on as being now... I don't have a copy of that.
Oh, you don't? Well, I can give you a copy.
Unfortunately. What we're finding out is that libraries put journals that far back in remote storage.
Oh, yeah. All right.
It's hard to find some of these.
I can get you a copy of that.
Okay.
It's a very short paper. In fact, you probably can dig it out right now. See, if I've also written that up for in more extensive detail for quantum mechanics. See if I have a copy of that. Disorganized. Quite accidental that I was able to find this. This describes the this is the essence of it, where you have protons which are charged, and neutrons that are not. If you ignore the charge interaction, then the potential well would have this common variety. But what happens is that because the protons repel one another, their potential is higher, and of course that extends to the outside. And that has to be compensated by the lowering of the neutrons, because the density, the overall density in the nucleus is pretty uniform, nucleon density. So you have this measure of the maximum momentum in which this neutron well is filled, and only this for the protons. So you get more neutrons than protons, and that's the basis of this thing. And then what comes out of that is this relationship here,
yes. Yes.
Which is exactly what you get from the empirical evaluation. Anyway, but you can look at that. I'll get you a copy of that reprint as well.
Okay. All right. more general sense, you got back to UCLA. How did you, what were you thinking of in terms of the projects, the research you were going to pursue? Was it an outgrowth of your World War II activity?
Yes, one of them was. We had, in looking at the adsorption,
thank you.
In the Manhattan Project, we were to understand that. Let me tell you a little bit about the UF6. This is this has a sublimation at about 60 degrees centigrade, at which the vapor pressure is 1 atmosphere. So you have to keep the temperature higher than 60, mm-hmm. and the pressure lower than 1 atmosphere in the process. But you're sort of running close to the condensation point anyway, the saturation, and therefore you can get adsorption, physical adsorption. But worse than that, since the conduits and the barrier and so on have metal in them, you get reaction. And you get the UF6 turns into UF4 or some other, the whole series of compounds with oddball UF4 and a half, for example. So it was important to know how much of the process gas is going to be tied up in the, that was one thing. Another was in evaluating the characteristics of a barrier. Remember that this is a thin thing, but it's full of, it has porosity. So you need to know, have some measure of the pore size. And one way to get at that is to measure the surface area. And the way to do that is to use the BET theory. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of this, we had found that there were certain substances that really latched on to the measuring gas molecule, nitrogen mainly, and there were indications that this adsorption was strong enough that you might be able to observe the thermodynamics of two-dimensional condensation. So that was one of the things that I was interested in. We carried that through in a fairly complete way with Billy Fisher, who was one of my earliest graduate students. So that was a holdover for a continuation of some of the Manhattan Project interests. At that time, I was also part-time at the RAND Corporation, where that was my other foot in the world of military affairs. And
how did you make that connection? Did that come out of your world, the Manhattan Project?
Yes. Yes, I suppose part of it was driven by patriotism, but it's trying to think what the origins of that was. There was a fellow here at UCLA by the name of Dave Griggs. I don't know whether you ever heard of him. He was a geophysicist. A very eminent one. He had been largely responsible for the formation of the RAND Corporation. RAND had started out as a section of Douglas Aircraft, and the guy who was the motivating force behind that from Douglas was Frank Kolbom, who had been the test pilot of the of the DC-2, going back a ways. So after the war, when this was formed, Dave Griggs became the first director of the physics department there. And he and I had become quite close friends just in the university. He was always camped on my doorstep asking questions about thermodynamics. He had found there's a guy at Berkeley by the name of Verhoeven who was kind of a competitor, and he wanted to understand what Verhoeven is, and we found quite a number of errors in his thermodynamics, and that just delighted Dave. So we were good friends. And then I got to know a lot of the people there at RAND, and I forget just the exact sequence, but anyway, I became a consultant there first in 1949, and Nancy became a secretary there, largely through the aegis of Bill Libby, who knew the management. So, now, there's something you haven't seen, which is a much more detailed account of activities in that area. Now, this, unfortunately, has not been updated for years because it's a big job. But, now, this is the academic stuff. Here are defense research reports now up through 75 that, for example, talking about RAND work here, some of the, you can just read the titles of those.
Yes. Yeah.
But they're all chemical physics, as you see.
Mm-hmm.
Some had important consequences. For example, this thing enabled the reduction in size of thermonuclear weapons by quite a bit.
Hmm. This is just for the record that you're looking at this one titled "The Reevaluation of the Equation of State of Lithium Hydride."
Yes, that was the one I was just mentioning.
Right. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to connect your statement with the one we're looking at.
Yeah. The lithium hydride, of course. One of the substances used in the thermonuclear weapon. A lot of these things are classified. You're going to see the secret research, secret restricted data. These are unclassified and so on. We had contracts with both Livermore and Los Alamos at the RAND Corporation to do this work.